Good morning, everyone, and welcome. My name is Sherry Hills, and I'm the Manager of Research at Ontario Creates. Many of you will know that in September, Ontario Media Development Corporation began using a new operating name, Ontario Creates, and we've taken this opportunity to rename our breakfast series, which many of you have come to, as the Discussion Series, freeing us to hold it any time of the day we want. We appreciate your patience as we transition our published content from OMDC to Ontario Creates on our website and on the OAP, our online application portal. This is the last session we're hosting here at Arcadian Court for 2018 in Toronto. We are hosting a Francophone session in Ottawa on November 9th. We'll be talking about marketing and distribution. If anyone's interested in attending or knows anyone in the Ottawa area that would like to, please get in touch with us. Thank you to Export member Alex Brown for joining us today. For those of you who don't know Ontario Creates, we're an economic development agency of the Government of Ontario. Our mandate is to build Ontario's creative economy, which includes the book, film, interactive digital media, magazine, music, and television industries. Our discussion series brings together people from different creative media industries to discuss topics that are of interest across the industries. We're hoping that this morning you'll meet some new people or reconnect with people you haven't seen for a while and get some useful takeaways that you can use. We're posting these breakfasts as podcasts, and you can find them on our website and also at iTunes and Google Play. Podcasts from the previous breakfast can also be found there. We'll be posting this morning's podcast within the next couple of weeks. If you're interested in our research, we're producing a quarterly research bulletin, which will be emailed to subscribers. You can also subscribe to research and other industry news at our website on the About Us page. This morning's session is called Tech Talk, Trends to Watch. Our panel will explore how new and emerging technologies such as artificial intelligence and blockchain are being used to improve business practices and marketing strategies for creative industry companies. We'll discuss tips for integrating new technologies in internal operations and deploying them for marketing purposes. We're pleased to have Angela Misery here to moderate our panel today. And our industry panelists include Shannon Culver, Manager of Technology at Ebound Canada, Jeff King, Chief Operating and Corporate Development Officer at SOCAN, Rachel Noonan, Director of Marketing Strategy and Communications at TIFF, and I'll leave it to Angela to introduce them properly in a moment. And now to our moderator. Angela Misery is the Digital Director at The Walrus and an award-winning journalist and author. Please join me in welcoming Angela and our panel. Thank you.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Let's see. Oh, well done. Good morning. Thank you for showing up so early. Feels very early, although some of us got here even earlier. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for Ontario Creates for putting together this discussion series. I'm really excited to find out what these panelists have to say. Like we said, questions are going to be kept for the end, and I promise we will find the time. I have people who are going to tell me when it's time to stop talking, so don't worry, I will stop everyone. So I'm going to ask Shannon and Jeff and Rachel to give like a brief bio of themselves and what they do right now, and then I'm going to get them to talk a little bit about some current technologies that they've rolled out that are working out or not working out. We'll talk about all of that. I am the digital director at The Walrus right now, which is awesome and amazing, and that's why a lot of you have a Walrus magazine that you're either sitting on or next to. And I love working there, and I've worked in digital my whole life. I worked for 14 years at the CBC in digital in various different jobs, and my favorite thing about working in digital is that you never know what's going to happen, which some people would find strange, but I enjoy. It's the same reason I write detective fiction. I like chasing down clues and figuring out why something's not working. It's the same kind of brain. So I'm really excited about this morning, and I'm going to start with Shannon. I'm going to ask you to give a brief bio and tell us a little bit about like one or two pieces of technology that you guys are just introducing.
Sure. So my name's Shannon Culver, and I'm the Manager of Technology at Ebound Canada. Ebound is a nonprofit organization that works with Canadian independent publishers to help them create, distribute, and sell ebooks. So we work with companies like Amazon and Kobo and library wholesale vendors like Overdrive on behalf of the publishers that we work with. We work with about 70 independent Canadian publishers. and also sort of keep on top of new technologies and trends in the field and help our publishers to adapt to the changing marketplace. Prior to Ebound, I was on the publisher operations team at Kobo, and I started there when there was about 80 people on staff, and ebooks were still very new, and when I told people what my job was, I had to sort of explain a whole industry, and by the time I...
Do that with my parents. Do you still have to do that
with your parents? Yeah. My dad recently was introducing me to someone and said, Shannon works at Ebound. I don't really know what she does. So I was at Kobo through a tremendous growth period. There was about 80 employees when I started and about 500 when I left. So I really saw the startup grow and sort of went through those early crazy days. So it's nice now to be at sort of a smaller, more steady organization, but it's also a lot of fun to do that, the wild startup ride. And a technology that we are thinking a lot about right now at Ebound is sort of everything that goes into creating audiobooks. And it sort of feels like where we were with ebooks, not myself, but Ebound the organization, a decade ago when it was this new technology and publishers were sort of saying, we feel like we should be doing this, but we have no idea how to make one, where we should be selling them. Yeah. And so we're sort of going through that whole process again right now with audiobooks. And it's a really fast-growing segment of the publishing industry. But there's so many new aspects of the technology and the industry that our publishers are figuring out, and we're trying to sort of help them figure out.
It's so interesting. I just had a conversation with my editor the other day for a new book I've written, and he said, I was listening to your manuscript on my phone. And I said, oh, interesting. So somebody else was reading out my words with his technology he was using. This was even, like, it's not an audio book.
Yeah,
it's basically an audio manuscript.
Speech, yeah.
Interesting, right?
Yeah, it's getting, that technology is getting a lot more sophisticated.
Yeah. Jeff?
Well, thanks for having me here. I was told that time is tight, so I'll just start off. I was born in Western Ontario and grew up in the Cambridge area. No, so I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the SOCAN Group. SOCAN is Canada's Public or Performing Rights Society, and that's what we're best known for. But a couple of years ago, we bought two other companies, which are now subsidiaries, MediaNet and Audium, that do much different things. MediaNet is one I think this room would be most interested in, and they're a content fulfillment company, and so they provide sound recordings to streaming services. So if the four of us wanted to start our own streaming service, MediaNet could power it, and it gives access to 68 million sound recordings with all the metadata and all those things with it, which is the real driver why SOCAN wanted it. But the ability to combine the different elements of the industry is very unique, and it's put us in a great spot, to the point where earlier this week we announced the launch of Dataclef, which is a new subsidiary of SOCAN, that will do back office and data management and royalty management for other similar companies around the world. We signed a contract in India, we've got a couple in the Caribbean, and there's a few more coming. On the technology front, there's a number of different things that we're looking at, but the ones that I'm probably most excited about are artificial intelligence and blockchain. And I think, frankly, both of them need new names. Artificial intelligence has images of Terminators destroying us all. And as we go through the panel, I'll tell you a little bit how we're doing that and to make sure the Terminators don't kill us. And blockchain, I think blockchain needs a new name. I think fundamentally it is hard to grasp, and the complexities around it are unnecessary. By the way, I spoke at South by Southwest earlier this year and announced to a group that this idea, and the room was around this size, filled with blockchain people. About three quarters of them were thinking, I can beat this guy up in the parking lot. And you know, they were just furious with me. But the reality is, the way I look at it, is that blockchain is like a verified Wikipedia. And so imagine if Wikipedia had like a blue check mark type system. And then you'd be able to go on and say, oh, this song was written by these folks and recorded by this band and is showing up in these movies. and sort of think, you know, I think of it as like a verified Wikipedia combined with IMDb for music. Mm-hmm. That's a lot less scary than all my information is going to be out there and the whole world can see how much I'm making, which is what a lot of people jump to with blockchain.
Right.
We're also doing some stuff with some big data things, but I'll save that for the end if there's not an avalanche of questions.
Right. So. You know, we had an interesting discussion, Jeff and I, about SOCAN. How many people here interact with a product or something from SOCAN every single day? Like, it's amazing how many places SOCAN touches, right?
We're everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So don't worry about blockchains. It's SOCAN you need to worry about.
Yeah. The NSA has nothing on us.
Yeah.
But you're right. I've been at SOCAN a long time, and it's funny to hear the references because my family members still. I've been here 17 years. People still struggle to explain it, mm-hmm. and they've got a family member working off of it. So I know how, you know, behind the scenes and anonymous it almost seems. But you're quite right. If you watch TV or do almost anything online or listen to music, there's a SOCAN license there.
Mm-hmm. Just don't tell people how much I listen to T-Swift. That's all I ask. Rachel.
Hi, my name is Rachel. So I've got two titles, clearly. So until recently, I was a director of marketing, communications, and strategy at TIFF, and most recently I've taken on a new role as a director of audience development. So for the last 2 years, I've been very focused on the external side, communications, and really figuring out how to engage our audiences. And now I've moved to how do we better serve our audience and actually evolve with the paradigm shift of the organization and have us as an organization evolve with that. So I'm doing a lot more research, quant and qual. I'm spending a lot more time on product development. So I'm somewhat of a hybrid now, supporting our programming teams as we look at new ways to serve our audiences, both online and physically. We have, many of you might know, we have our festival, small little festival that happens every year called the Toronto International Film Festival. And then we also have the TIFF Ballet Box, so it's a year-round cinema and a film reference library, an education institution, and we do a variety of things with and for the community. We have a lot of fundraising initiatives right now. We're fast and furious with Share Her Journey, which is about supporting female filmmakers across the board, creating mentorship opportunities and reducing barriers for them, which is really exciting. So we've been working on that for the past 2 years, and we've got a 5-year plan against that. Since day one in the organization, technology has been a thing. My background is in arts, entertainment, and fashion, and I have a love affair with technology. I've been obsessed with it since a young age. My mom was a software technical writer for Alias, which was a 3D software company. So I was the first kid with a computer, and you know, it was deep-seated from a very young age. So I was always the curious cat. I was always the person that wanted to know how to do things better, and technology oftentimes was the tool and the resource that could help you get there. For TIFF, you know, trying to narrow down the technologies recently that have been the most important. So some back-end stuff that, you know, I find equally as sexy, maybe other people won't.
I do.
Okay, cool. So from the back end, we've onboarded, I mean, Ticketmaster is a partner of ours, and we've had them for about 2 years now, and that's actually a massive technology partner that we've been familiarizing ourselves in terms of the resources and everything that we can do with them to optimize our consumer experience. But we also don't have a centralized CRM as an organization, and it's not as sexy as blockchain, again. Mm-hmm. It's not as ethereal or Ethereum, pun intended. Mm-hmm. And we onboarded a product called Umble to try and solve the consumer insights problem as we are navigating what our CRM is going to be as an organization. So Umble is a kind of a one-stop shop where you can get social sign-on and you can better understand your customers. For us, there's a huge value because we literally have a budget of $8 to market to our audiences. We're a very conservative charity, and we try and put as much money in the programming as possible. So a product like Umble allows you to understand patterns of behavior. A lot of the stuff that some companies are tracking manually, some are using an Adobe Cloud or a very, you know, variation of products. It also has front-facing interfaces to do contests and really simple widgets and things that we can't afford to build every time. So that product has been extremely valuable to us. And in the same breath, because we have hundreds of thousands of people in our building and I can't possibly greet every one of them, we onboarded a really good social sign-in tool, which we've gathered you know, we're, I don't know, about 8 to 10 months into that product, and our success rate is 120%. So the majority of the people that are coming in the building are signing on through social. We're getting email addresses, so we have the ability to engage them afterwards. And then also we can market to them through the interface, and we can test and trial. So A, we can use it for data capture, and B, we can actually try things out, see what resonates. You know, the way Netflix is basically testing every minute we turn on the platform, we can do something similar. So try imagery versus text and see how consumers respond to that. So for me, those are really exciting ones. Customers will never see Umbel. And from the social sign-in thus far, to my knowledge, you know, we've had, you know, hundreds of thousands of interactions and one complaint, which for me is a pretty beautiful moment when it comes to launching a new technology.
Isn't it funny? Because you remember when we first had public Wi-Fi, and I remember the arguments people would have about giving social Wi-Fi to people, like just allowing people who come into a building and all the arguments against it. Like, they're all going to serve porn on your Wi-Fi. And I'm like, I don't think that's what people do. But it's, I don't know why everyone doesn't do it.
It's there are still philosophical questions that get approached about. And most recently, actually, so the privacy mechanism or the challenge, we're pitching an idea to track consumers' behavior so we can serve them before, during, and after, and using a certain type of mechanism. And I still have the fear. So it's the same thing as like the Disney band. The Disney band tracks everything that you do with social sign-in. All you do is you get their email address. You just get the right to actually talk to them. And then they can refuse, or they can have an email like kittykitty123@hotmail.com, and they're not a human.
Right.
And that is their choice. So they get the service. But it's we need to be very transparent with that. And we have a lot of language. And anybody that reaches out to us, we talk to them about that transparency. So there's nothing hidden, which is half the battle.
Yeah.
But IT endeavors to be as buttoned down and as careful as they can be, understandably.
I know. I can't believe these arguments are still happening. But speaking of arguments, my first question for you guys is, how do you find... Okay, how do you negotiate amongst a group of people that are not going to be either as tech savvy or as tech adventurous as some of us are? How do you negotiate with people outside of your exact department? I'm going to start with you, Shannon.
Sure. So in my position, that's something that I do a lot, because we're sort of a catalyst for looking at new technologies and new ways of doing things, and then educating and sort of bringing the publisher clients that we have on board with that technology. And a lot of the ways that we sell and promote books in the digital environment is very different from the way that things have been done with print. And so there is often a degree of buy-in that needs to be secured in terms of explaining new models. One example is typically the way that we've sold books to libraries in the digital space is based on the way that books are sold to libraries in the print market, which is a library buys one copy of an ebook, and one library patron can take it out at a time. Mm-hmm. And then if someone's got it out, everybody else has to go on the hold list. And so that model is called one copy, one user. But with digital, and sort of an additional thing is that if the library wants more than one person to be able to take the book out at a time, they have to buy multiple copies of the book. So it's totally replicating the print model. But we're starting to see now systems where instead of having the librarians sort of have to guess, or the acquisition staff at a library, like, I think we're going to need 5 copies of this book and 10 copies of that one. There are systems where the model is pay per use, and so they make all of the books that a publisher has available to library patrons, and then the library only has to pay for the books that are actually taken out.
Yeah.
And so it sort of takes some of the guesswork out of the librarian having to forecast how many copies and which titles they should be buying. Instead, you can just sort of make everything available to library patrons, and then the library can see, you know, look at all these people who have read this book that we did not anticipate that would happen. But it's new and scary, and the payment models are different for publishers, and so we do have to sort of show, you know, what the revenue will be like and ensure them that it's not going to cannibalize their print sales or their one copy, one user sales in ebooks. And there's a lot of sort of education and encouragement that has to happen around those new models.
I believe it. That's a very adaptive model. I like it. Jeff?
Yeah, for me, it's I really come back to language is important. And technology, and especially some of the things that we're talking about on this panel, really leads itself to technobabble and jargon and all these things. That's not helpful. That doesn't work with folks other than, say, early adopters or people immersed in the space full time. And let's face it, most people are not. Mm-hmm. And so typically what I'll do is I make sure that I'm able to communicate it in an articulate way that people can comprehend it, put it in terms they can relate to, mm-hmm. and really push sort of the business value of it. And it ends up being a much different conversation mm-hmm. than saying, give me your data, or those types of things. If you show a value in that, it's just a different dynamic, and staying away from the notorious three-letter acronyms and all those things. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks in my sort of peer universe are very prone to that and are keen to show off how much they know and all the rest of it. And they do know a lot, and they're very skilled and such. But they can't speak to the masses, or they can't conclude a business deal because it's just so so advanced. And I think that's probably my secret weapon. And I try to make it so that you know, my son, who's in grade 9, can understand everything I'm talking about.
Wow.
Right? And if and he's kind of tech savvy, but not really.
Yeah.
And if I can do it in that way, I know I'm starting to hit a note. And that's the important part. And especially when you got, just like all of us here, a wide variety of demographics who we're dealing with, from the young up-and-comer who's just starting out to a sophisticated person running a billion-dollar business in a similar space. And I think being able to move and have cadence and have good terms of use, like, I don't mean contractual terms of use, I mean ways to explain it. Here's what blockchain really means.
Right.
Here's what artificial intelligence, this is what it really is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's helping, you know, our case studies are really around matching and identifying music performances, or helping to find up-and-coming acts or new amazing people, different things like that. If I explain how that works, and I'll, you know, for instance, for finding new amazing acts, we're using artificial intelligence to comb through social media. Mm-hmm. The real power of AI, frankly, is the processing power. So we're doing a bunch of different experiments with the U of T and with MIT, but also with IBM, with Watson. And with Watson is one we're most advanced with. Watson's able to process 700,000 Facebook pages a second. So over the, and we were blown away by this when we turned their engineers loose with our engineers, and we started combing through all social media. And over the course of a week, we're able to see every tweet, every Facebook post, everything. And we started to notice some different things popped out. So if you're mentioned on Twitter, but it's sort of in your general postal code, you know, the M2 series or M4 and that type of thing, it tends to be friends and family. It's great that they love you and you probably have some skill and such. But when you get mentioned outside your postal code or a zip code in the U.S., all of a sudden, oh, wait a minute, you're catching someone else's eye. And then so that allows us to sift through the noise and start saying, oh, we better reach out to these folks and, you know, get them, you know, in the program, so to speak. There's all kinds of very sophisticated math and logarithms and all the rest of it behind the scenes. We don't need to talk about that, right? And I think that's been a big part of why we've had some good success with this stuff.
That's amazing, yeah. I'm going to start clicking on my husband's music from different places outside of my postal code now. Now I know how to do this. What do you think?
Oftentimes, it's not just the language. It's that the person you're talking to's livelihood is attached to that language.
Right.
So the subtext is they're afraid. And I did a talk recently with a bunch of innovation people, and the people that were organizing it, they kept asking me for my slides. I was like, I'll get you my slides. I was like, you want my slides? Cool, here's one slide. And it says, don't use the word innovation. So the whole talk was about that, and I use this example because we're not unique, one-of-a-kind snowflakes. Like, these are repeating patterns that you go back in history, and if there's one book that helps contextualize that is What Technology Wants by Kelly, who's the co-founder of Wired. It's an amazing, painful book to read, but it makes you realize we're not insignificant, but, like, kind of check yourself and your language, and So my dad is a complete opposite of my mom. He's an Irish immigrant, blue collar, worked as a dispatcher in a courier company. He controlled cars with a pin board. So like he would move the cars around the city and it was these little kind of paper pin, you know, he pushed pins and he ruled this world, this analog world that he had. And I was a really young kid when they started to introduce pagers and computers and they didn't teach him, they told him. And they came in, and even as a kid, I realized like this is not gonna go well. And he, you know, he fought it and he was afraid because it was attached to his livelihood. He didn't understand the language, he didn't understand the context and he didn't understand the future he was working into. And you know, he maybe didn't have as sophisticated people to help him transition into that, but I did a program at OCAD, a Masters of Innovation and Foresight, and a big part of that is change management and really understanding what the subtext is, because nobody gives a big care about Ethereum, but like eight people do, right? So like you said, backdoor that stuff and try and find a way to connect with that person in you know, in a human way and understand what the future implications are for your stakeholders, which is extremely difficult because sometimes you can have 11 people in the room that all have different objectives and needs and wants. And that's also the tension with building the house from, you know, the foundation up, setting it on fire and rebuilding it. If you have a company that has to change from within, especially if the company, and most of our companies are in a huge state of disruption, it doesn't matter if you're in trucking or you're in music. People are afraid for what their futures look like. So I would say empathy along with contextual language probably.
Also making the effort to understand what they get from this, right?
Like yeah, totally.
It actually requires that. So I'm going to do something that in my other life, I teach at Ryerson. I teach the first year journalism class. And one of the things I tell them not to do is do two-part questions. And I'm about to do a two-part question. So nobody tell them. So my two-part question is, do you need a champion when you bring in new tech? And the second part of the question is, how do you chase down? How do you stay abreast of new tech? I'm going to start with Jeff this time.
I think there's a variety of things. I'm going to give a four-part answer.
I asked for it.
I'm kidding, but only partially. I do think there's a lot to be learned by studying what happens at the companies that do not adapt. And two case studies I'm really interested in, I find quite fascinating, are Kodak and Nintendo. Kodak and Nintendo were both started in the 1880s, within a couple of years of each other. Kodak, well known, was the preeminent camera and film manufacturer for decades, unassailable feature of the Fortune 500 for most of the existence of the Fortune 500. And Nintendo was a playing card company that diversified into Love Hotels, which are what you think they are, and a whole bunch of other different things. But they kept adapting and kept changing and kept trying to move things forward and differently. And really embrace technology. And when it started to look like that home computing would not just be people with spreadsheets and the parents doing their taxes, but also kids playing console games. And they moved and shifted into that. And Kodak just poo-pooed digital cameras. As a matter of fact, Kodak filed the first patent on a digital camera, but thought no one would ever do it. It's a $20,000 camera, and the quality was like basically 0.1 megapixel. They said, who's going to use this? Right. Totally misread what the situation was and put their heads in the sand. I think you have to be adaptive and change. And as we know, Kodak eventually went bankrupt and now just flogs its name for licensing purposes. Whereas Nintendo is not thriving, but is doing well. And it's a good lesson for all of us that you're never as unassailable as you may think you are. Competitors can come out of nowhere, and you have to have a hunger inside the culture of the organization. If it's a one-person setup, or if you're an army of 5,000, you have to have a real drive to want to keep changing and evolving. And then the sort of final part of my four-parter is the internal champion. And having champions does make a difference. Yeah. Someone who's really passionate and focused on it can really move the needle. I'm a big head and heart person. I think if someone's smart and they're willing to work hard enough, they can do almost anything. Right. And I've seen it over and over again in my career, people who have that head and the heart and they invest and they change things in an amazing way. And I think it's important to do that. And a champion, you want to have someone who's got their hand up saying, I want to do this. Yeah. Not, here you go, I got assignment for you, get on this. No, that doesn't work because it just ends up, you're pushing a rope and you make small baby steps. reward leadership, embrace different generations, all those types of things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Rachel, champion and staying abreast.
Yeah, you need somebody because it can be really alone, lonely time when you're out there and you're trying to sell something. Also, that doesn't necessarily have a quantified return on investment. When I was coming here, I was talking to a research analyst who donates their time because we can't really afford research analysts at TIFF, but they're doing some research for us to substantiate something that I want to do that is proven. It has market data, and still I have to come in and compel the world that this is a worthy investment. And to your point, it's also it's a culture. So breeding a culture of prototyping and finding somebody who understands what that means. So, you know, if you go to somebody who's building a startup right now, who's been through an MBA program, they get what a sprint is. Like, it's native language to them, whereas certain people, they don't understand it. The iterative process is foreign because they feel like something has to be completely baked to the point where I'm trying to get a pilot off the ground right now, and all of our internal stakeholders are asking me for every component of this thing before this thing is a thing. So you need a leader to give you a bit of space to either fail spectacularly or get enough data to understand how to move things forward. And as an employee or somebody starting a company, A, you can breed that culture and also find those people, ask the right questions, see where they're investing their money. You know, if you follow the money, it usually gives a clear indication as to the bets the organization is making. And then that can give you a sense of calm when you're going to be the individual also pushing that innovation and that change. And to your point around an internal staff or staff members that are excited, it's hard to find, but then once you find them, move space for them, which is tension filled because usually it has to be associated with their performance, and they need to be, you know, celebrated, remunerated, whatever the return and investment is. It can't be on the side of your desk work. So if it's on the side of your desk work, it ends up being treated as such, and then it's an anecdote and it doesn't get built into the culture. And there's a really good example, Netflix, because they were making money hand over fist with their subscription business sending to home, right? It was just a cash cow. It was ridiculous. And the story goes that, you know, certain people in the organization said, you know, streaming thing's going to happen. We're going to move in this direction. And many stakeholders in the organization said, you're crazy pants. We're making so much money over here. How can you cannibalize your business? And I think they waited approximately 8 months. And if people were not on side and part of that future, they were let go. Smart, intelligent, great people that were not willing to be part of that disruptive culture. So you can actually find their culture deck. Mm-hmm. Go online, just if you guys haven't seen it yet, it's like Netflix culture deck. Disruption is built into the company, which I'm sure creates a bit of instability on a daily basis because everybody's challenging each other all the time. But it keeps them pushing forward and testing and trying and iterating. And you want to be at a place like that because the world continues to move in that direction. So,
great. Shanna?
Yeah, just sort of thinking about what Rachel was saying, I do find working at a nonprofit organization, there's a bit of a tension in being like a technology company and then also a nonprofit organization because we are reliant on government funding for some of our revenue. And with when you're applying for sort of long-term grants, you have to have a plan ahead of time and you have to sort of follow through on the schedule that you've given and then be able to report on it. And there was a big poster on the wall outside the staff room at Kobo that said, move fast and break things, which I think is a Mark Zuckerberg quote. And like, you can't move fast and break things at a nonprofit organization. It's not really how it works. So sort of finding the middle ground of being able to try new things, but then also sort of sticking with your core mandate and your services and remembering the audience that you are trying to serve. We're really fortunate in that my organization, Ebound, was created as a result of members of the Association of Canadian Publishers sort of recognizing when ebooks first came onto the market, like, this is a really big new thing. For each of us to figure it out on our own is going to be a ton of work and beyond our bandwidth. And so let's mobilize our resources and find a way to sort of do this all together. So we really have a lot of buy-in from our clients. And then also we've got a great board of directors who are very enthusiastic about us trying new things. But you also have to carve out like the space and time to do the research and to find out about new ideas and to think about what you could be doing. And that I think is also a challenge when you sort of have your day-to-day set of tasks and responsibilities to sort of give yourself and your team the time to say, what else could we be doing? What else is going on out there that's interesting and that could be useful to us, but maybe requires a bit of wrapping our heads around something new?
I know. At The Walrus, we don't really have a huge team. It's literally 25 people in a basement that create that magazine and the website and the podcast and, you know, the app and everything else. But we have an R&D hour. We have an R&D hour once a week where
That's
we talk
great.
About R&D
yeah.
stuff that we really want to put some time into, because we don't have an R&D department, but
yeah.
everyone needs to be thinking about R&D, right?
Yeah.
So I have a last question, because we're going to go to questions from the audience, and it's basically, when you look at the big pieces of technology you've brought in-house that you've championed, that you've managed to either implement or trying to implement, what are the things you learned from that? Like, what are the do's and don'ts? So I have an example where we started a chatbot about 6 months ago, and we took it on from another partner, and we started using it, and we you know, pushed it in social and all that stuff, and we didn't have a goal. It was just basically, we should try a chatbot, and nobody really had a plan. Is this for engagement? Is this to push people to newsletter? Like, what is the point of this chatbot? It was put out there without any real plan. So my don't is, let's not just take on a new cool piece of technology because it's trending today, and actually plan for what we want to get out of this. What is a win? What is a loss? What is a success? What do you guys have as examples of that?
I'll go first, I guess. Mm-hmm. The chatbot's an interesting one, because we're just toying around with that right now,
right.
And we got this similar issue. What do we want to do with it?
Right.
And a similar thing that we had done was bringing in business analytics. We call it Royalty Guru. You can analyze your earnings. You can do some predictive analysis for the mathematicians in the room to see how much a song would earn, or if you're on 3 minutes on global once a week, how much does that generate? That type of thing. And when we built this and put it out, I thought, oh my God, this will turn the industry upside down. We're geniuses. It's clear.
Yeah.
You know, just ask us. And about 80 people use it. And they use it religiously, and it's studied to death, but totally missed the mark. And so we're expanding it, and we're changing it and making it different. And I think there's a couple of things, lessons for me. One is humility, and to realize that if you build it, they won't necessarily come. But also, don't be shy to say, this isn't working, and let's change it
yes.
up. You know, yes. being stubborn only works for bulldogs. You
right.
know, so.
Well, that's good advice. Yeah. Rachel?
Something that we've done recently, which is not a new technology, but we've launched on WeChat and relaunched on Weibo. And, you know, technology shifts or investment is also a change in culture, and the same with launching on a particular channel, because you have to better understand your audiences to also understand what technology they use. So for something like WeChat, A, it's a totalitarian dictatorship. I will stand behind that. It is so hard to get on. The application process takes, it's a kind of as long as they want it to take. So it could take 2 weeks, could take 2 months. It's a very arduous process. They ask for pretty detailed information. So understanding that maybe your CEO doesn't want to give their social insurance number out is, you know, something they should think about. But when you get on it, you start to realize, well, A, QR codes in North America, for the most part, just never picked up, right? It's used throughout China everywhere. QR codes are an embedded part of the WeChat experience. So us as an organization has to respond. In addition to that, WeChat, it's a whole ecosystem, right? So you do everything in WeChat. There's no translation. Like, you have to have native Mandarin Cantonese speakers on there and then understand how you're going to customize language. And then we have to think about, do we bring in WeChat Pay? So if you've been to Yorkdale or some places in the city, and even small little... one of my colleagues was in a small little restaurant about 400 square feet in Markham, and they only take WeChat Pay. That's it. That's the only payment source of payment that they take. This is not a possible future. This is a probable future. So we have to think 5 years ahead. I mean, we just upgraded our regular POS. So that the infrastructure stuff for us, we're still endeavoring to move forward. That's also a big tension, because how do you either divest and invest, or how are you, especially as a nonprofit organization that has a high level of fiscal responsibility, able to invest in something like WeChat Pay, where maybe there's, and also their numbers aren't very transparent. So my guess is there's, you know, 100,000 people in Toronto on WeChat. I have no way to substantiate those numbers. Same with WeChat Pay, because right. their numbers are confidential. But, you know, you can try and find transactions from publicly traded companies, but then you have to get beneath the weeds. So you have to convince your superiors to make those investments, and that's a massive part of the market that continues to grow. So yeah. For us, that was kind of an interesting domino effect to starting something that seems so simple, but now has opened the door for so many other things.
So before I go in, I'm going to come talk to you into WeChat.
That's yeah. Okay. Shannon. I think one thing we've learned from a few sort of different projects we've done recently is that you should go and talk to your target audience and find out what they actually want or need before you build something. And one of the projects we have worked on in the past year or so is a discoverability layer that Canadian libraries can use to surface recommendations of Canadian books based on things that library patrons are searching for, which in theory sounds really cool. And we find a lot of the library platforms we work with, like Overdrive, which you'll be familiar with if you take books out, e-books out from the Toronto Public Library. Those are American companies. They don't care about identifying Canadian books. But when we went and talked to librarians, a lot of them said, you know what, you can make these books more discoverable to me, but I'm still going to be beholden to patron requests and what our patrons typically take out. Mm-hmm. And so even if I know about all these great books, if it's not what patrons want, we're not going to buy it. And so that was sort of like, oh, okay, so we yeah. need to come at this a different way. So we've been sort of rejigging that project.
So interesting. Okay, so I'm ready for Q&A. Look, we hit it right on. Nice. Awesome. So there are microphones that you guys can grab to ask some questions. You can ask all of us or you can ask one of us. We will not be offended either way. Who has a question? Wow. We have solved all problems.
Hello.
Over there. Yes.
It's on.
Is it?
Yep.
Oh, whoa.
Oh.
Thank you for sharing your stories. That was a lot of great advice. If you could just recap and maybe summarize some of the key trends to watch in tech, that would be really helpful.
Key trends to watch in tech. Who's got something? I think Jeff's going to say
I feel bad. I don't want to be the first person every time.
No, okay. No, please.
Please, I don't want this to be a microaggression or something on me later. One of the big ones, I think, is going to be the continued rise of machine learning. And artificial intelligence and all the offshoots of that. We're starting to see early stages of computers able to program themselves and to do adjustments. That's going to be a rapid growth area, even in the next 18 months. We're doing a lot of interesting work with the electric car manufacturer right now around a customized streaming service inside their vehicles. It's a whole other leap forward. On the surface, it'll seem like regular Spotify and Apple Music, but it's going to be much more sophisticated. That's an emerging trend that's happening rapidly, and frankly, there's probably no one in no industry or no group in Canada that could finance or do that type of thing. You know, IBM Watson, which is sort of the godfather of all this type of stuff, cost, depends who you talk to, $60 to $70 billion to develop to get to the stage to be on Jeopardy and to beat Ken Jennings. Which was amazing, and they've gone so much further since then. You know, the entire creative community on Earth is not that big, and so there's no way we could afford to do that type of thing. So I think we're going to see a continued rise of partnerships and disintermediation, cutting out middlemen. You know, and that's going to accelerate at a blinding pace, and will be scary for a lot of people. But if everyone in this room is an early adopter, you're here because you have an open mind, you want to learn, you want to interact. I've learned a ton from these folks today, even. And I think that's going to go at such a pace, it's going to change our, frankly, our civilization. Mm-hmm. And hundreds of years from now, this will be one of those seminal moments, just like the 1880s with steam engines and early electricity.
You heard it right here, this moment, right here.
Yep.
Ladies. Also,
this panel.
There's also, there's location-based stuff, and there's the LBMA. If people haven't looked up the Location-Based Marketing Association, they have a lot of amazing / creepy things that are happening. Oshiega's Music Festival is an example. They tracked everything that you were doing from the app to the restaurant to the hotel you were at and helped optimize the experience. What there also is, there's a counter-trend to that. So a counter-trend to self-fulfilling prophecies, to confirmation bias of algorithms that are telling you what you want, how you want, and where you want it, because it becomes a feedback loop. And we've heard about it in the news a lot in terms of, you know, our Facebook feeds and the manipulation of our minds. I mean, it's a bit meta, but it's not, because, you know, the private companies that are controlling these algorithms, like Google's an amazing product, to use it every day. 85% of their revenue comes from advertising. They are not a company of happy high fives. They are a company that's generating a strong amount of revenue from advertising, and that's okay. But, you know, when you're using search and you're going online, whether it's music or information about, you know, wars in foreign countries, there needs to be some sort of a counterbalance to that. So as purveyors and professionals in this space, you have the opportunity to also ask those questions. And they're hard ones, because when the train's moving really fast and, you know, nobody wants to make sure that, you know, the lines are straight or the gas is full, somebody has to ask those questions. Is really important, because you want to discover. I want to discover movies and film that isn't at the top of my list, that isn't a published playlist, that is a sponsored playlist. Like, I want to find a stumble upon, or whatever you guys refer to, you know, as the random discovery. So understanding in your businesses how you can do that will be really, really important, because, you know, cognitive dissonance, conversations, like the reason why humans come together is because you find those weird random books. Like the first book I ever read when I was able to read and understand was Charles Bukowski, because of my dad, right? If I had gone online, I never would have found that online. Yeah. Absolutely no way would like a 14-year-old kid have been able to, maybe they could have, but with the algorithms the way they're set up today, how does that discovery happen, and how can you guys be a part of that is really important.
Good one. Shannon? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think just to sort of dovetail with what both Jeff and Rachel said, the biggest sort of nut to crack for book publishers right now is dealing with Amazon and their search results. And that's the sort of primary project that related to this panel today that we're working on, is using machine learning technology to generate keywords that are put into the metadata for books and then sent to Amazon to be indexed into their search results. So we've been working with a company that uses machine learning technology to scrape sites like Amazon itself for their customer reviews, also Goodreads, which is an online literary community where people leave reviews of books, and basically anywhere on the internet that readers are talking about books, to actually see what are the terms that people use when they talk about books on the internet, because we found that there's a difference between the terms that editors and people in the marketing staff at publishing houses use when they describe books, and then the terms that people who do not work in that industry and don't have all this sort of jargon and lingo use when they're looking for a book on Amazon. So discoverability is a really big issue for us.
Have you ever worked at a bookstore?
No, I've never worked in a bookstore.
I find that people are searching by I have this red book. I don't remember the name. I don't remember who wrote it, but it was red.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, maybe that should be in the search results. Like,
red books.
That's actually great. Yellow that should books. Be a keyword, like red cover.
Honestly, work in a bookstore for a while, that you get the craziest questions.
Yeah. So I think the machine learning element of sort of figuring out how to put your book in front of the people who would like to read it is really key for us right now, because there are millions of books on Amazon. If you just upload a book to Amazon and let it stay there, it will wallow
Goes
in
nowhere.
The abyss of the internet forever.
Preach. Preach. Totally true. I would say I'm going to put on my journalism hat just to answer that question and say that I think a lot about fact-checking and verifiability, because it's getting harder and harder to determine if something is true in this current atmosphere as a journalist. So that is something I think about a lot. When you said, you know, verified accounts, I always think, who verifies those accounts? And we just trust that Twitter has verified that account. They have no transparency on how they do that. And we have no insight into it. So I think a lot about transparency, fact-checking, and because I work at The Walrus and we do that all day. Any other questions from the audience? Yes, over here.
First of all, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. It's really informative, and I really enjoy it. And this probably goes out to probably Jeff and Rachel. Not sure so much with Shannon, but... what are your opinions about, especially for someone Jeff King, someone working for SOCAN, how does the sort of how does live streaming affect the creative industry of just North America in general? Because we're starting to see more and more consumers. Starting to use live streaming services like Twitch or YouTube Live, and subscribing to people, and we have creators, content creators, who are making a lot of money. One example is Ninja at Twitch, who makes about $100,000 a month. I think last month or something. Wow. Really insane. So I was just wondering, how does that affect, is that a disruption, or is that something as a trend that the Toronto or Ontario creative industry might want to take advantage of?
Jeff?
Definitely live streaming is it's a huge trend, and it's about to explode. Now, there's licensing complexities, and we license them, Twitch, and we're happy to do that. But there's other issues to deal with. Other different rights are involved, and even exploitation, you know, how do we keep track who's doing what when, and who should get paid for that license fee, different things like that. We're doing a lot of very interesting things around audio identification on that front. Not dissimilar to using the same technology to how we find general licensing opportunities by comparing against search results and using geographic locations to compare against our database of licensed locations. Same idea for live stream. I think it's going to explode as we move into G5, the latest technology for wireless and mobile. And also it's going to explode geographically. Right now it's largely a North American and Western European phenomenon. But we're going to have 1 billion devices in Africa fairly soon. And in Asia, there's already 1 billion devices with varying degrees of what we would call broadband connectivity. That's going to explode throughout 2019. And I think we'll see live stream become an incremental, an add-on. I don't think it'll cannibalize things so much. It'll be a new additional thing. I think that's one of the things that technology that we're seeing in the last couple of years, a lot of hand-wringing over cord-cutting. But the reality has been cord stacking, and people watching Netflix while looking on their phone for trivia about Haunting Hill and all that stuff, and we're seeing a lot of that type of activity. I think live streams will be another one of those things, especially around Twitch and the gaming, PewDiePie, all these guys.
Rachel, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, for us, live streaming has been a way to promote, reach a larger audience. We take a lot of our programming, conversations, our festival is live streamed, usually on Facebook and on YouTube. So it's helped with our international reach in a really major way and driving people back to our core product. You know, the future could see us offering live streaming services behind a paywall. But again, the consumers are telling us kind of what they see and value. And for us, the human connection is extremely important in the transformation process of using film as a conduit and a conversation starter. So we're a global brand with, you know, kind of a domestic footprint, which is really interesting for us, but our numbers go through the roof when we live stream stuff, and then we put them on YouTube afterwards. We're also a charity, so the terms in terms of how we use that content, what we do with it, is bound by terms and conditions that a charity would use. So, you know, we don't license a lot of our content either outside of our ecosystem, and if we do, it's a very rare occasion. It's interesting, you know, there's a documentary called, I think it's Sound City, and Trent Reznor and Josh Holmes are talking, about the availability of technology also. Like, they're talking about Pro Tools, and everybody can pick up a guitar, and anybody can, you know, make a beat. Does it make more better musicians? No, not necessarily. The cream, you know, the cream is still going to rise to the top. Yeah. So when you go onto Twitch and you go onto Steam and you go onto all these different platforms, 99% of the product, the numbers are extremely low, they're not moving, and that other stuff does rise to the top. Same with esports and a lot of those guys. For us, those pieces to the puzzle haven't necessarily disrupted our business. Houses, homes, and people, you know, living in their houses with the on-demand piece to the puzzle is a bit more of a tension for us.
Interesting. I think we have time for one or two more questions. Hey.
Hello. Oh. So thank you guys for the discussion. I don't have necessarily a question for you guys, but I just want to make a comment. Jeff, thank you for bringing up the Kodak story. I just recently graduated from an MBA program at U of T, and in our strategy course that we took in our first year, first term, we talked about Kodak. And I have to say that in 70s, it was 75 students in our section. Everybody gasped at how spectacularly Kodak failed, and how they, you know, and I think, you know, when people are thinking about, oh, how are we going to adapt? How are we going to change? A lot of people tend to look at the companies that are doing very well, and try to replicate that for their own company. But, you know, to your point, thank you for mentioning that it is important to look at how a company has failed, because Kodak, you know, their issue started at the very top. Bill Gates sat in a room with them and said, I want to work with you guys, Microsoft and Kodak. And Kodak CEO said, nah, you know, we're not going to need that. It's going to be, you know, we're not going to go to the digital route. And this was like 30 years ago. And who knows where they would have been now had they, you know, maybe gone through that partnership. And so just the importance of really looking at companies that have failed and why they failed, because usually it's a very fundamental situation or reason why they failed. And so keeping that in mind, if you're trying to adapt your strategy or, you know, bring in new technology or improvements, you know, really seeing what are the fundamentals that need to be addressed before you, as you know, implement that technology.
Good. Blockbuster too. Yeah. Oof. Yeah. Ooh. Still sad. Okay. I want to say thank you to Ontario Creates for having us, and please could we have a round of applause for our amazing panelists?